Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Elliot Bazzano. For every program, we choose a new and exciting book and chat with the author. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Rory Dixon, Assistant Professor of Religion and Culture at the University of Winnipeg, about his exciting new book, Living Sufism in North America, Between Tradition and Transformation, published by the State University of New York Press in 2015. Rory Dixon's book is the first monograph in English to focus on Sufism in North America. On this note, he takes a risk by marking himself as a trendsetter in this emerging field, and he succeeds admirably. The book offers a fine balance of historical analysis, ethnographic fieldwork, and theoretical frameworks which can help inform future studies of Sufism in the West and in North America specifically. Although there are a few edited volumes that explore Sufism in the West, Dixon's single-author voice gives continuity to his study and narrative in an important and unique way. One of the elephants in the room, moreover, that he tackles head-on is in response to the following question: what's the relationship between Islam and Sufism? In a way, responses to this question are what produced the phenomenon of Western Sufism in the first place, and the cacophony of voices that continue to address this question animates much of Dixon's book. He treats a number of so-called Islamic as well as so-called non-Islamic Sufi orders and remains in conversation with the various time periods and influences that affect his work throughout his well-written and fascinating book. Thus, although he focuses on North America, the reader is frequently reminded that Europe, South Asia, and other places are also an important part of the conversation. On top of Dixon's careful attention to detail, extensive footnotes, and thoughtful placement of excerpts from the many interviews he conducted, he writes in a very inviting and accessible manner, which will likely draw broad readership, ranging from scholars of Sufism and American religion to journalists, as well as lay readers wishing to know more about America's layered interactions with spirituality, Islam, and religion in general. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Rory Dixon. Good afternoon, Rory. Thanks for joining us here on another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies.
Good afternoon, Elliot. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, super excited to talk with you. And I was thinking also it's exciting to talk with you as well because I was recalling when we first met about 10 years ago, we actually ended up talking about Sufism in North America as one of our sort of get to know you sorts of things. So it's so cool to see you writing a book on the topic.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. No, I remember that too. It's hard to believe it was 10 years ago, but
yeah, that's another issue about time flying. But so one of the questions we like to start off with on the program is for the authors to tell us a little bit about how they got interested in the field. So how did you get interested in Islamic studies broadly and then in your book topic specifically?
Yeah, well, I think for myself, I got what I would call the religion bug in my late teens, where I just became really fascinated with religions in general and was sort of reading everything that I could on them. I pretty soon was focusing in on contemplative traditions. And then soon after that, started to focus on Islam and Sufism in particular in my own interests. And so that started to translate into writing undergraduate papers on Islam and Sufism. And then when I was in graduate school, I met my who would become my doctoral supervisor, Professor Mina Sharifi Funk, at Wilfrid Laurier University, and was really inspired by her approach and decided I wanted to work with her to do a PhD on the subject of Sufism. Now, the program that I did my PhD in, it's a joint program at Wilfrid Laurier University and the University of Waterloo in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And that particular program has a focus on religious diversity in North America. So it was a good fit for studying Sufism in this region.
Mm-hmm. So aside from your doctoral supervisor, were there any either texts that you came across in graduate school or during this sort of religion bug contemplative search you're talking about that had a really big impact in shaping your interest in religion?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. It's kind of hard to narrow it down. I mean, you know, interestingly enough, when I first started getting interested in religions, probably one of the first books that I read was Houston Smith's World Religions Introduction. I still think it's a fantastic book. I mean, obviously it's been critiqued as reflecting an older understanding of religion, but I still think it's a fantastic book. And, you know, that was certainly something that piqued my interest. I think as I got more into religious studies, one of the things, even more than texts, I guess I would say, probably people that I was working with kind of helped this turn towards field work was a big one for me. I'm a pretty avid reader, as most people in academia are, I think. But it was having professors kind of push me out into the field, so to speak. People like Ron Grimes, Michel Desjardins at Laurier, who really offered a lot of training, a lot of enthusiasm for field work. And that, I think, really took it took a turn in my work when I started to focus on that.
Awesome. And I want to get back to this idea of field work, which is obviously one of the really salient aspects of your book, and I think sets it apart from other types of work in the field. But so now, thank you for telling us a little bit about your background, how you got interested in things. So if we can just jump into the book now, let's start with the title. So it's Living Sufism in North America Between Tradition and Transformation. So I think the geography is pretty straightforward, but I think there's some key words there that say a lot about some of your concerns and interests. So could you say something about what you mean by living Sufism?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, living Sufism is to emphasize the fact that I'm studying Sufism as a tradition that is dynamic, that is changing, and I'm particularly looking at that dynamism, at that change. One of the things that I found when I was studying the subject was the diversity. I mean, I was really struck by the diversity of Sufism in North America, and I was also really struck by the fluidity of the tradition, the way in which it was being adapted in a whole variety of ways. And so I think that's why I wanted to include that term. In terms of tradition and transformation, basically that was highlighting what I think is one of the main tensions that I found in my discussions with Sufi teachers, Sufi leaders, was this tension between what to maintain from the traditions that they had learned and been trained in, and what to transform or change for their North American students. And that particular question was one that they differed on quite profoundly. I mean, that I felt that was sort of a pivot point where you would see some particular orders based on how teachers answered that question, going in one direction and other orders going in another. And so that idea of this tension between maintaining elements of tradition or transforming them was why I focused on that in the title.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about the ethnography then. So you mentioned, you know, talking with actual Sufi teachers in the flesh has been an important part of your project. So could you tell us, you interview and talk with groups, you know, all throughout America. And so could you say a little bit about how you set up these site visits and maybe what some of the more memorable experiences you had were?
Yeah. So, I mean, one interesting thing I found about it was, and I would think this might be helpful for people who are beginning a project that involves some field work, is certainly you sometimes have to knock a few times before doors start to open. And, you know, you have to initially send out a lot of emails, not maybe get as many responses as you'd like. But one of the things that I found is something like a snowball effect in a sense. And really the first interview that I secured for the project was with Pirzia Inayat Khan of what was the Sufi Order International, recently been renamed the Inayati Order. And once I was able to interview him, it was really nice then to email other Sufi teachers and say, I've just finished an interview with Pirzia Inayat Khan. Would you be interested in, you know, participating in this project? And even having that one interview seemed to really open doors with other Sufi teachers. And of course, once then you get two or three, you know, then you can send out an email saying, I've interviewed these people, and it really helped the momentum of securing interviews. Uh-huh. So that was interesting. I mean, one interesting thing was also different teachers you know, operate differently. And I'm sure we'll chat a bit more about Syed Hossein Nasser, but in particular as a scholar and practitioner who identifies as a traditionalist, I think really one of the main reasons why I was able to get an interview with him is that I was actually friends with one of his students in his Sufi order, who said, look, if you really want to contact him, you should probably handwrite him a letter. You know, don't email, but actually handwrite and mail him a letter, and that will, you know, probably bear more fruit. And sure enough, I did that and was able to get the interview with him. So,
yeah, that's a cool story. To, you know, people still handwrite letters. It's good to know. So, obviously, you know, you're mentioning that you're an avid reader, and obviously you're engaged in this topic of Sufism and have been reading on the topic for a while. So once you started your ethnographies and interacted with people, mm-hmm. how did this, like, change the kinds of questions you were asking and the way you were thinking about your project?
I would say it was pretty radical, you know, and this gets back to having professors like, you know, my PhD supervisor, Mina Sharifi Funk, and Ronald Grimes, Michelle Desjardins, Carol Duncan, people who were I was taking courses with, who were on my PhD committee, all of whom really had this emphasis on the importance of fieldwork. And, you know, I didn't really get it until I started going and visiting Sufi centers and spending time there, interviewing teachers, you know, seeing rituals. It was radical, I would say. And one of the ways that it affected my study is I'd done all this reading beforehand, and I had these sort of neat categories in my mind of, well, this is going to be an Islamic Sufi order. This is going to be a sort of Islamic or quasi-Islamic Sufi order. This is going to be a universalistic or non-Islamic or New Age. And I sort of had these categories relatively cemented in my mind from the readings that I'd done. But when I actually went and met with Sufi teachers and spoke with people at their centers and spent time at their centers, I started to find that what I was seeing was, in a sense, dissolving some of these categories. I started seeing some of these sort of both and, where I thought, well, this doesn't quite fit in this category, but also doesn't quite fit in that one. And so that became one of the big findings, I would say, of my research, was that, you know, when you really spend some time up close with Sufi groups and speaking with Sufi leaders, you start to find that it's a lot less easy to categorize them than, you know, I expected initially.
Right. And I think that's one of the real strengths of your monograph is that, you know, you include a lot of your dialogue and text directly from the words of these people. And so it gives a chance to see how, you know, oftentimes in very, what we might identify as like non-academic kind of speech, which I think is a good thing oftentimes for the sake of clarity. But you really get a chance to see people articulate this question, or the answer to this question of, like, what does Sufism mean to you?
Right.
And, yeah, you get a lot of different sorts of responses. And so this question, obviously, that you're asking throughout the book, what is Sufism? And you're getting all sorts of different responses. You refer to what you call classical Sufism and mm-hmm. sometimes contrast that with newer, maybe more Western forms of Sufism. Mm-hmm. So could you give us a sense of what you mean by classical Sufism in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think talking about classical Sufism is talking about Sufism as it sort of crystallized in largely, we could say, just say the medieval period. But classical Sufism is usually associated with some of the formulators of the tradition or articulators of the tradition, right? So people like Al-Ghazali, you know, Rumi, Ibn al-Arabi, you know, people like that. I think beyond the sort of authors, the figures of classical Sufism, you tend to see more within the classical tradition a pretty comfortable synthesis, definitely after, you know, 10th, 11th centuries of Sufism with the other discourses of the Islamic tradition. So there's a sense in which Sufism is relatively seamlessly integrated into a holistic Islamic paradigm that includes the Sharia, that includes Kalam, the Islamic theology, Islamic philosophy to a great degree. And so you see it relatively well integrated into the larger Islamic tradition. Now, that isn't something that you see consistently in Sufism in North America. There are certainly Sufi teachers who perpetuate that what we might call classical synthesis. You know, we might even call this more broadly the sort of classical Sunni synthesis of elements of philosophy, theology, law, and Sufi spirituality. And so certainly, you know, you see that being perpetuated, but it isn't the only game in town, so to speak. There's kind of a range of approaches to that tradition.
So could you tell us about some of those ranges? And so the terms often are really important, right? Whether people want to call themselves Islamic Sufis or how other people might want to frame them and call it quasi-Islamic Sufism or non-Islamic Sufism. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us about sort of the range of these categories and also what's at stake in the names that people use?
Yeah, and I mean, and I think this was also one of the things I found is I wanted to talk to teachers themselves and say, hey, what do you think of these categories? You know, I mean, as scholars of religion, we formulate categories, but I was really intrigued to hear what they had to say. You know, do you think you fit in some of these? How do you understand these terms? You know, I wanted to really get their perspectives on this. And what I found is in my conversations with them, there was a lot more nuance than I think is always captured in categories. Now, certainly, there were some who identified quite closely with Islam in terms of their identity practice, emphasizing the things like the five pillars and following the basics of Islamic law as being key to the practice of Sufism. Now, even then, though, I found that those teachers who emphasize Islamic identity and practice at the same time often had a very universal sense of Islam. You know, they had the sort of a dual sense of Islam, we might say. Islam is the historical religion crystallizing around a set of beliefs and practices and laws, but also Islam in this sort of deeper metaphysical meaning of a state of being in submission and surrender to God. And so you would often find that even identified Muslim Sufi teachers would articulate an understanding of Islam that went beyond the confines of the historical tradition. As I met different Sufi teachers, I also found some who explicitly identified as non-Islamic, which I thought was interesting. So I wrote about the Golden Sufi Center and Llewellyn von Lee in particular as a very interesting case where he identifies as being non-Muslim and his order as being non-Islamic, and yet is perpetuating key elements of what we might call classical Sufism in terms of lineage, the importance of relating to a sheikh or a spiritual teacher, you know, maintaining daily spiritual practice based on the lineage. So, you know, really what I found was there was a lot of nuance that was not being captured in the categories. And some categories I didn't really feel were all that workable. You know, nobody, I think, wants to be called quasi-Islamic, for instance. I don't think it's something that people really identify with. Nobody wants to be called New Age. You know, that term in particular was one that most people bristled against. And I think with good reason. I mean, it's a largely pejorative term, I think, now. So, yeah.
So did you find that if you, like, asked people, you know, tell me about your tradition, would they volunteer, like, we're non-Islamic Sufis? Or is that the kind of thing that would come up because there was a question you were, like, specifically interested in learning about?
Yeah, well, you know, I was specifically asking them about their understanding of the relationship between Sufism and Islam. Because it is a controversial issue for both Muslims and non-Muslims, and it's also a point of a key point of difference between Sufi orders in North America. So it was something that I was specifically getting at, and I really wanted them to speak to their understanding of Islam and Sufism and how the two relate. So certainly I was asking them questions on that subject. But, you know, I mean, I got very different answers, right? I mean, I think of even Pir Zia Inaya Khan of the Inayati Order or the Sufi Order International, who in some ways has been steering that order in what we might call a more traditional or Islamic direction. You know, it has a quite universalistic history in the sense that the teachings of the order were open to all, and most of the followers of Inayat Khan's predecessors didn't consider themselves to be Muslim. But Pir Zia Inayat Khan says, I do. You know, he said, I do consider myself to be Muslim, and I see this order as you know, grounded in Islamic teachings in some sense. You know, so I think it was just having them speak about their understanding of Islam and Sufism really gave me a lot of insight into the variety of approaches to the subject.
And so you've said a little bit about why these so-called non-Islamic Sufis would have something to say about the relationship between Islam and Sufism. Can you also say why the idea of Sufism itself is even controversial within a sort of more quote-unquote orthodox kind of Islamic framework?
Yeah, I mean, there's a really sort of interesting history here. For any of us who do Islamic studies, pretty early on, you can't help but appreciate the prevalence of what we would now call Sufism within the pre-modern Islamic tradition. Even sort of separating it out as its own category at times doesn't really fit with what was going on. I mean, it was just so fully integrated into Muslim devotional life that in some cases, to really separate it out would be impossible. Now, that prevalence of Sufism has really changed. I mean, I think it had a relatively comfortable place within the Islamic tradition for centuries, as I said, as a sort of integral part of it. But really, in the past few centuries, we've seen anti-Sufi movements develop and gain, I think, a significant amount of influence globally. And this has really marginalized Sufis in Muslim communities in the past, definitely in the past century, but I would say even more so in the past 50 or 60 years, we've seen a pretty concerted marginalization of Sufi movements. And it's largely from movements that are affiliated with what we might call the sort of Salafi movement, which, of course, there's a number of different approaches within that. But they tend to share a suspicion of Sufi movements as being, having religious innovations, divinizing material objects or people. And those sort of suspicions of Sufism, even if you have Muslims who aren't specifically affiliated with Salafi movements, those suspicions of Sufism have really percolated quite widely. And so I think there is a lot of controversy around now today, the place of Sufism in Islam, a controversy we wouldn't have seen or would have been inconceivable, three or four centuries ago.
Mm-hmm. And the irony, perhaps, I'd be interested what you think, is if these, so-called anti-Sufi folk looked at a lot of incarnations of Western Sufism, it would, confirm their worst fears about innovation and, not taking the tradition seriously.
Right, and I think this is why it's a particularly charged topic. You have a lot of Muslim Sufis who, in some ways, not always, but in some ways want to distance themselves from some of these more non-Islamic forms of Sufism, because, as you say, it seems to confirm the worst fears of the anti-Sufi movements. And so there's a sense of, we really need to distinguish Islamic Sufism from Sufism that is less or non-Islamic. I certainly get the let's say, historical impetus behind those things. But, my interest was to really just try to document the diversity of Sufism in North America in its fullness. And, the readers can make their own decisions about what is authentic or not. I just really wanted to give voice to the different perspectives and really, present them as fully and as nuanced as possible.
Right. And I appreciated that reading the book as well, is the tone that really pervaded the text was fair-minded in a way that was intentional, and I think, as we discussed, that really gives voice to the people you're interviewing. So, in terms of dates, which I think is another strength of the book, you are clear about how very historical time periods come together. So, when was it that Sufism first came to the West, and the idea of dissociating Sufism from Islam began to take place in a clear, articulate sort of way?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so when we're talking about, Sufism coming to the West, I think we need to distinguish between Sufism as a literary tradition. So certainly there were various scholars of the Orient, who we call Orientalists, who were studying Persian literature in particular and Persian Sufi literature. And this literature, I think, was one of the first ways in which Westerners encountered Sufism. And they quite liked it, but they didn't think that it was very Islamic, in part because, as we know, some of the Persian Sufi poetry has a sort of countercultural approach. Not always really understood, though. I mean, it's countercultural within an Islamic context. But I don't think that people like, William Jones or, they didn't always have that sense of how this poetry fit into a broader, what we might call Islamic paradigm. So certainly, in the late 18th century and into the early 19th century, there's this interest in Sufi poetry. But really, as a practice, as a sort of living tradition, we might say, transmitted as it's historically been transmitted from a sheikha, from a teacher to students, that didn't really happen in the West until more the turn of the 20th century. And that's where we see individuals, particularly Hazrat Inayat Khan, who is the founder of what was the Sufi Order of the West and the Sufi Order International, now the Inayati Order. And so he presented Sufism in a very particular way. Interestingly enough, he initially attempted to teach some more Islamically, we might say, grounded practices to Westerners, to both Europeans and North Americans, but he found they didn't have a whole lot of interest in it. And so he increasingly decided, well, if I'm going to transmit this tradition, I need to transform it, so to speak, and quite radically. And so a number of his students being more involved with the Theosophical movement, he started to basically transmit elements of his Chishti Sufi lineage in a more Theosophical model, in a Theosophical form. And so certainly there we get a separation of Sufism from Islamic identity and practice, and that, I think, has been influential historically. Now, interestingly enough, around the same time in Europe, we see René Guénon, who is seen as being really the first founder of what's called the perennialist or traditionalist movement. And Guénon converted to Islam, in a sense. I mean, he certainly was a practicing Muslim and became a Sufi. And his particular approach, most often called the traditionalist approach, basically sees Sufism as something that must be practiced within the realm of Muslim identity and law. And so really we see these two kinds of approaches in early 20th century Western countries, one where you have a European convert saying that Sufism can only authentically be practiced within the confines of Islamic identity and law, and a born Muslim Sufi teacher sort of bringing Sufism beyond or outside of the confines of Islamic identity and practice.
If we wanted to try and understand this kind of relationship in modern terms, would this be something like spiritual but not religious?
Well, it's an interesting term, and I think with a lot of these terms, it becomes difficult in part because not everyone agrees on precisely how to define these, and really they're categories that we've created for relatively diffuse phenomena. So they're inherently difficult to define, I think. One of the ways why, I think there is an element of Sufi practice that certainly corresponds with what we might call New Age or what we might call spiritual but not religious. I've tended not to use those terms in my research because I've been focusing on Sufism as it's practiced within Sufi orders. And so I think there's something a little bit different there. Like, I'll give you an example. If let's say you're somebody who's read a few books of Sufi poetry and it really resonates with you, but you have really a whole host of spiritual reading and interests and practices, but maybe you start calling yourself Sufi or you start meeting up with some people and reading some Sufi poetry together. Sure, in that way we could call that spiritual but not religious. It's relatively loose. It's relatively diffuse. It's eclectic. It's profoundly individualistic. I think those terms might fit a bit better. But if you look at Sufism as it's practiced in North America within the orders, even those ones that identify less with Islam, you still find that it doesn't really fit the spiritual but not religious or New Age models. You know, rather than being a sort of eclectic individualistic practice, they're still usually based quite closely around a particular sheikh or sheikha. So they're usually based around a Sufi teacher that one enters into a master-disciple relationship with and has a sort of long-term commitment to that teacher and that particular lineage, and it, you know, consistently engages with the practice of that lineage. You know, I have a little bit harder of a time calling that, you know, New Age or spiritual but not religious, because it tends to fit within more what we might call, you know, classical or traditional models of contemplative paths.
Mm-hmm. And then the Golden Sufi Center, like you're saying, is a really interesting model of that, because there are all of these sorts of clear connections to what we might call classical Sufism, even if its participants resist the Muslim kind of language. But also along that note, did you find that especially the non-Islamic Sufi folks that you were interviewing, did they have any resonance or discomfort with thinking about what they're doing as religious and religion?
I mean, it's an interesting question. You know, I didn't necessarily ask them about this question of spiritual or religious. You know, those weren't really terms that I was using in my interview questions. It was more, you know, how do they identify themselves vis-a-vis Islam, or how do they understand the nature of Sufism in relation to Islam? Mm-hmm. You know, and again, it's kind of a tough one, because it really comes down to how we're defining these notoriously difficult to define terms, spiritual and religious. I mean, I know there are some scholars of SBNR or spiritual but not religious who will say, well, look, you know, it's all ultimately religious, you know, in some form. It's just a different form of religion, or, you know, so you can kind of get into these debates. But I think with people who fell along the closer to the non-Islamic spectrum, end of the spectrum, there was really some interesting differences. I mean, I think there certainly is a sense of tying Sufi authenticity to Islam that has emerged largely since the 1960s, when you started having more populations of Muslims coming here from various parts of traditionally Muslim countries, who themselves understood Sufism as being something inherently Islamic, and authentic Sufism as being something inherently Islamic. You did see a response from the following the 1960s of some Sufi teachers who had been more affiliated with the non-Islamic or universalistic trends, increasingly tying their traditions to Islamic roots. For others, though, you see less of that movement, less of a sense of saying, well, we need to identify more with Islam. But certainly what I found is they all, as a rule, I mean, and I guess they're certainly a part of the order system, but they, as a rule, they all emphasize the importance of lineage. That was something that started to be foregrounded, is that regardless of how they identified with Islam, you know, having a lineage of teachers going back to the Prophet Muhammad and being able to show that you are a part of this lineage was really important.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned a few of the key figures that have played a role in the history of Sufism in the West, Sufism in North America. And one person you alluded to is Sayyid Hussein Nasr, your beautiful example of the handwritten letter. Could you say a little bit more about what you were able to discuss with him when you interviewed him, as well as his position in this tradition more broadly, especially since he's a little bit unusual because he's an Islamic studies scholar as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sayyid Hussein Nasr is very interesting in terms of his relationship with what we might call, you know, the broader category of Sufism in North America. As you say, he's a very well-known scholar of Islamic studies, very influential. He's trained a lot of very important scholars in the field. But what is less well-known about Sayyid Hussein Nasr is that he himself is a sheikh, is a Sufi teacher within a relatively unique Sufi order called the Maryamiya, which is a branch of the Shadali order that was founded by a European spiritual teacher, Frithjof Schuon. And this particular teacher, who was an associate of Genon's, had a very particular approach, which again we call either traditionalism or perennialism. But certainly it's an approach that differentiates itself somewhat from what we might call mainstream or traditionally orthodox versions of Islam. It is definitely universalistic in the sense that perennialists believe that at the heart of every religious tradition is a contemplative or esoteric path that is fundamentally sound, we might say. That, you know, that basically the different religions are different expressions of this higher truth, and that their contemplative or esoteric traditions offer genuine paths to this higher truth. And so there is a real universalism to the perennialist movement, and certainly Nasser shares that. But the reason why they're also called traditionalists is the sense of that Gwenon and Shuon had, that Nasser continues to have, that these esoteric or contemplative paths found in Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, indigenous traditions, that although they're all valid, they all need to be practiced within their respective religious forms. So there's a strong emphasis on religious form and adhering to a religious form. So you get an interesting mix of an emphasis on, you know, identifying, in the case of Sufism, identifying with Islam, following the basics of the Sharia, you know, fulfilling the obligations of religious practice, while at the same time having this sort of doctrine that tends to see really it being equally legitimate to follow Buddhist contemplative traditions as long as one is a Buddhist, and really seeing you know, no difference between the two as long as one is adhering to the religious form.
Mm-hmm. I think exactly what you've articulated, by the way. I hope that undergraduates especially will listen to New Books in Islamic Studies interviews as well as this interview, because I feel like in a really clear way you just articulated how, like, weird religion is when you pay attention to the details, and that these sort of simplistic, you know, visions break down quite quickly when you start to ask some of the more important questions. So thank you for that, especially for my students. So Syed Hussein Nasser fits into this Islamic Sufi paradigm, but it's also a little unusual because he has this European teacher who initiated this order in a bit of an unusual way. Could you say something about some of the more quote-unquote Islamic Sufi orders in the United States that you talk about in the book?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly, I mean, one example would be the Jarahi order in the United States is one that in general tends to be a bit more closely aligned with Islamic identity and practice. And really I think perpetuates some more traditional patterns. But of course, one of the very interesting things that I found when I was looking at the Jarahi order in the United States is that there are a number of branches of the Jarahi order. And so when you look at the different branches of the Jarahi order in the United States, you see some very interesting differences in how Islamic identity and practice is being taught. So if you look at the branch of the Jarahi order that's led by Tosin Beyrak, it's a little bit more what we might call traditionally oriented. It's more connected with the heads of the order in Turkey is where it originates from. And it's a branch of the Jarahis that will allow people who are non-Muslim to be associates of the order, but will not allow them to be full members. So if one is going to be a full member of this branch of the Jarahi order, one does need to be Muslim. And I've attended a number of their sessions, and they're always their dhikr practice, their practice of the recitation of various prayers and God's names and such is always framed by the Salat, so doing the Islamic daily prayers. They tend to meet in mosques. They tend to maintain traditional norms of Islamic law in terms of gender separation and dress. But what's interesting, of course, is even that particular branch, when I was speaking with Robert Frazier, who is a sheikh of this more traditional branch of the Jarahi order in California, you know, he really emphasized, again, this sort of dual understanding of Islam that, well, yes, you know, basically we are Muslims and we follow the Sharia, but what Islam really is something that goes beyond all of that. You know, it's something that, he actually quoted a saying from his sheikh, Muzaffer Ozak, a Turkish sheikh who really brought this order over, who said, you know, sometimes Muslims are the hardest people to make Muslim, right? Which is this idea that, you know, you may have the identity and you may have the practice, but are you really in the spiritual state of being in submission or surrender to God? So I was always very fascinated by how even teachers who were very grounded within what we might call a traditional or orthodox form of Sufism, still wanted to emphasize these sort of more universal metaphysical meanings of Islam. And now if we look at the other branch of the Jarahi order led by Sheikh Fariha in New York, she is Muslim. The majority of her followers are Muslims, but one doesn't have to be Muslim to be a full member of the group. So she said, look, you still need to love the Prophet Muhammad and you need to, you know, love this path and want to practice it, but you don't necessarily have to be, a Muslim. And so there is more of a mix of Muslims and non-Muslims in that particular group. And the other thing that, Sheikha Fariha said is, she said, you know, look, we teach Islamic practices like Salat, but we don't teach them as obligations. So that would be an important difference between the more traditional branch of the Jarahi order, which would, for the Muslim members, they would understand Salat as being something that, as all Muslims tend to understand it, as something that is obligatory according to the Islamic legal tradition. But from Sheikha Fariha's perspective, she said, you know, we don't teach these things as obligations. We teach them, but we teach them as things that people do because they're spiritually effective, because they lead to spiritual knowledge. So we teach them as effective tools that you don't have to do, but if you try out, you'll probably find that they're useful. So a kind of very interesting nuance there in the approach to Islamic practice.
Mm-hmm. So along the lines of all this diversity, and you've said a bit about the sort of tolerance, for lack of a better word, that different teachers and groups exhibit toward one another. Was that something that surprised you when you started talking to members of different groups that might have different, really, really different visions of what Islam and Sufism is, like the judgment or lack of judgment that they ended up having towards each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall, I was probably somewhat surprised by how little judgment there was between the groups. I mean, one example of that was talking to Haisham Kabani, Sheikh Haisham Kabani, a leader of the Naqshbandi Haqqani order. And he is somebody who maintains a very traditional style of dress. He's somebody who's written books on Islamic law and closely identifies with what we might call the classical synthesis of Sharia and theology and Sufi spiritual practice. And so it was somebody that I expected might have criticisms for groups that were adhering less to Islamic identity and practice, but he really didn't. You know, he said, I would never want to judge because, you know, he said, look, this is how we approach it. We understand it as a whole package that includes Islamic identity and practice. I know some people don't, but he said, you know, we're following how we've been taught and what we think is best, and they're following how they've been taught and what they think is best, and, you know, who am I to judge? I really have no say. I found people more on the closer to the non-Islamic side of the spectrum also saying, you know, look, this is how we've been taught. I mean, Llewellyn Vaughan Lee said, you know, my teachers very specifically taught this in a non-Islamic way, but that's just because that's how they were taught. And he said other people understand Sufism more as an integral part of Islam, and that's how they've been taught. And so, you know, what is really no problem here. They're just different approaches. The only exception to that, I would say, was when I did interview Said Hossein Nasser, again reflecting the traditionalist sense that spiritual practice is only valid within a particular religious form. He was somebody who definitely was more vocally critical of non-Islamic Sufism, or what he would call sometimes New Age or California Sufism. And these were terms that he used specifically for what he felt were forms of Sufism disconnected from the Islamic tradition that he felt were not really going to be effective spiritually. So, and again, that comes out of this traditionalist or perennialist school of thought, which tends to have a pretty strong position on the need for a religious form for spiritual practice to be valid.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the figures you've talked about might have roots in different parts of the world, whether it's Iran or India or even Western Europe. As you did your research, was the demographic component of these group members something that you found to be telling or something that the practitioners reflected on?
I mean, it's an interesting question on you know, what are the orders, you know, what are they, how do they work in terms of who's joining, who's becoming a part of these orders? And I think one thing that surprised me in some cases was the way in which orders that I suspected to be almost entirely white, you know, middle or upper class people. People that we tend to associate more with what we might call the New Age movement or spiritual but not religious. In some cases, those orders had a very interesting demographic mix. For instance, when I was at it's called the Abode of the Message, which is quite a beautiful center in upstate New York for the Sufi Order International, or now the Inayati Order. And sure enough, I mean, it was majority demographically white, but it was also interesting to meet, you know, Muslims who were participating in the order, who had, you know, recently come to the U.S. from other parts of the world. So, you know, I remember in the kitchen of this particular center, just sort of chatting with people there and chatting with a Tunisian Muslim who, you know, had been in the United States for a few years and was wanting to connect with Sufism and found this particular group to be one through which he connected to the tradition. So, I mean, examples like that I found kind of striking, but certainly I think you could say some groups exhibited more demographic diversity. The Naqshbandi Haqqanis, for instance, are a group where you see a pretty apparent mixture of African Americans, white Americans, Muslims from South Asia or the Middle East. So yeah, some groups I would say did stand out. In terms of the diversity, also the Bawa Mahedin Fellowship is an exemplary there. It's a group that early on in its history drew people from the Philadelphia area from a whole variety of backgrounds, and so it's kind of maintained that demographic diversity to this day.
Mm-hmm. So, continuing along the lines of demographic diversity and representing the world, I know you've. If we could look beyond the book to a degree, at the book, from beyond the book, you've spent a bit of time traveling throughout the Muslim world. I was wondering, have you had any kind of striking interactions with people in Muslim-majority countries when you tell them about the kind of thing that you're studying, which is already going to seem pretty unusual to a lot of people in America, and so I'd imagine it might resonate with people in a particular way abroad.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I can say, I mean, when I was in Egypt for about a month this summer, and, you know, one of the things that you find in a place like Egypt is an interesting sort of polarization in how Muslims understand Sufism, and this gets back to a little bit what we were talking about earlier. So, you know, obviously, I in places like Alexandria, I would go visit Sufi mosques and Sufi shrines, and of course, when you speak to Muslims there, you know, really you do get this sense of a total seamlessness. Again, the categories of Sufism and Islam are not as distinct in places like that as they are here, where we tend to think of Sufism as this distinct analytical category, which I just don't know if it is quite as much. It seems to be much more integrated into Muslim life for those Muslims who participate in what we call Sufism.
Right.
But the interesting thing is, of course, you also yet Muslims who are completely convinced of the totally un-Islamic nature of Sufism. And so I would also have experiences where I would speak to them about what I was studying, and it was almost like I couldn't really say the term Sufism without them saying, look, I really have to tell you, this has nothing to do with Islam. You know, this is a something that really is a total perversion of the religion. You know, it's something that has been brought in from other religions. And, you know, so, you know, great, you can study Sufism, but just know it doesn't really have anything to do with Islam. So that kind of very interesting polarity between Muslims who have a hard time even separating the categories of Sufism and Islam because they're so seamlessly integrated, and Muslims who have a hard time even imagining the two spoken in the same sentence. So, you know, that was something really interesting to encounter.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like this theme of what is the relationship between Sufism and Islam is like kind of the perennial question in both within the United States and various types of Sufi orders and abroad. It's something people struggle with. And I think your book, in a way, tries to get at some of the different ways you can answer that question.
That's exactly right. I think so, yeah.
So along the lines of like pedagogically asking questions and guiding people towards answers, you're a university professor, you wrote this book in a very accessible manner. So I couldn't help but wonder, either do you or do you have plans to use this or excerpts from it in the classroom?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I was fortunate enough to teach a seminar on Sufism in the fall of last year, which is a really great class that I enjoyed it. I thought I had wonderful students here at the University of Winnipeg, religion majors predominantly, which was nice. And so we had this course on Sufism, and towards the end of the course, we focused on contemporary Sufism and Sufism in North America. And so I was able to use some chapters of the book in the class. I didn't assign the whole book because, you know, Sufism in North America wasn't the focus of the entire course. But I think one of the things that I like to do if I'm including my own work is I'm just going to throw this out there. I think it's good to kind of acknowledge the fact that it can come off as being presumptuous. I mean, I think we've all had times where people are assigning their own stuff, and sometimes students kind of joke, oh, you know, of course we're going to be reading their stuff.
Right.
So I like to kind of joke it and say, look, I know I'm assigning you my own stuff, but, you know, here's why. You know, here's why I think it actually does fit with what we're trying to do. But I actually found it's nice in a way, and I think students actually enjoy it in a sense because they know that they can ask you a lot of questions about something that you've written. They can ask you questions about why you've chosen to present things in a certain way. If they find an element of an interview interesting, they can say, oh, what was it like to actually meet that person? Or, you know, so there's really a lot of unpacking that can be done with stuff you've written yourself, and especially material that's connected with your main area of research. And so I found that actually really nice to be able to sort of go off on these tangents into the backgrounds to the research, you know, the contexts to the research. So I thought it was a good experience.
So building off that, one of the things that you explore in the book is how these different Sufi teachers sort of adapt their message according to their audience. Mm-hmm. And so do you have any recommendations for educators in terms of how they might use excerpts from your book or teach about Sufism in the West more broadly to North American audiences in particular? Like what's going to resonate with an undergraduate, you think, most well?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that's incredibly useful, and I think anybody who teaches religion has a pretty clear sense of this, is always emphasizing the diversity within traditions. I think people tend to formulate these ideas of religion as a sort of static category, unified. And I think it's so important to show them why there's incredible diversity and dynamism within traditions, to really make that understanding, help them understand it in a more complex way. And so I think one of the uses of a book like this is definitely to show people the extent of this diversity within a tradition like Sufism, which I think can only help their general sense of diversities within religion in general.
So going beyond the classroom, so I'd like to ask you one more question before we conclude things and ask you a little bit about current and future projects. But So I think it's clear the book is written towards a scholarly audience, at least, as well as maybe other kinds of audiences, who's interested in American religion and Sufism and how these things intersect. Are there any scholarly audiences that you would like to reach that you think might not be immediately inclined to pick up the book or broach the topic for whatever reason?
Yeah, I mean, I think a book like this should really be of interest to people who do ethnography, who do the sociology of religion. I mean, books like this can be something of a case study that helps them theorize. So, I think it could have interest to that broader population of scholars. I sometimes wonder about Islamic studies scholars as well. I mean, sometimes I know we can be trained in a more classical orientation, we might say, of languages and texts. But I think it's also important for scholars of classical traditions to get a sense of contemporary traditions, what we might say, you know, living traditions. So I would hope it would be of interest to people from those backgrounds as well.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, again, I found it a really challenging but also accessible read and found myself edified by it. So before we conclude, one of the things we like to do at New Books in Islamic Studies as well is ask our authors about current as well as future projects that you're working on. So is there anything you're currently working on that you could share with us, either that's related to the book or that goes beyond the book?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a few projects that I think are relatively related. I've just completed a manuscript of an introduction to Sufism with co-author Mina Sharifi Funk. It's called Unveiling Sufism from Manhattan to Mecca. That should be coming out next year. And that's an introductory text to Sufism, but one that we are trying to write in a unique way, we hope. Basically, we are doing a reverse chronology. So most introductions begin with either the sort of pre-Islamic Near East, you know, Muhammad and the Quran, and then kind of work from there. But we call it From Manhattan to Mecca, Unveiling Sufism from Manhattan to Mecca, because we begin with Sufism in the here and now in contemporary North America. And then in each chapter, work back through history until we get to the formative period of the Sufi tradition and before. The other thing we're doing with that book is integrating in each chapter, looking at how Sufism relates to politics, philosophy, spiritual practice, and also the arts. So we're really trying to give a three-dimensional picture of how Sufism has functioned in different periods of time. So pretty excited to have that book come out next year. And then beyond that, we've got another project that we're doing with Shobana Xavier on contemporary Sufism more generally. And that's trying to pick up some of the trends that we're seeing in contemporary Sufism more globally, not just limited to North America.
Cool. Sounds like an exciting agenda. And so grateful that you could share a little bit about your book with us today and your future plans. So thank you again, Rory. I learned a lot from your book. I know it's inspired ways I want to talk about things with my students, and I can expect other people to have similar experiences. So thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's fantastic to hear, and thank you very much, Elliot, for inviting me. It was my pleasure.
That was my conversation with Dr. Rory Dixon, Assistant Professor of Religion and Culture at the University of Winnipeg, about his exciting new book, Living Sufism in North America, Between Tradition and Transformation, published by the State University of New York Press in 2015. Thanks for listening.